This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
There are rules for trade wars, you know. I just thought that's an important thing to mention. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Wednesday, today, the 22nd of January. Good as always to have you along, everybody. The macroeconomic quote of the day today comes to us courtesy of Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin via the World Economic Forum in Davos, at which Mnuchin was on a panel where the conversation turned to European plans for a special tax on big internet companies, most of which the big internet companies are, of course, American. Here is the Treasury Secretary.
I think we've been pretty clear that we think that the digital tax is discriminatory in nature. And, if people want to just arbitrarily put taxes on our digital companies, we'll consider arbitrarily putting taxes on car companies.
There is a lot in that 16 spare seconds of audio, so we're going to take it apart a little bit here for a bit. First, the basics with Molly Wood. She is, of course, the host of Marketplace Tech. Hey, Molly.
Hey, Guy.
All right. So hit me with a very quick primer on the idea of a digital tax. Explain.
Yeah, you have a lot of companies in Europe saying that there are these companies whose product is primarily digital, right? It depends mm-hmm. on data from their citizens, and they're making a lot of money in these countries. And they're saying, look, we should get a piece of this revenue pie. It's business being conducted here. It's taken away from local businesses. So France kind of kicked it off with this 3% digital tax, and several other countries are prepared to follow suit.
And the U.S., as Mr. Mnuchin said, just does not like it. Why?
The U.S. does not like it. You heard him say it is discriminatory. Mm-hmm. It really does. You know, the tax is on companies that make more than about $850 million in annual revenue globally. Mm-hmm. And in the example of just France, do 25 million euro worth of digital sales in that country. So if you do that math, that's about three companies, Google, Facebook, Amazon.
Right.
You know, and they're saying this is a target on American companies, and it's taxing these companies over and over and over on the same revenue.
And in point of fact, we should say that the president said maybe a couple of weeks ago, if anybody's going to tax these companies, America's going to tax these companies. So there's also that. Where does this go, do you think?
Right. Well, not away. That's for sure. You know, despite the sort of state of the discourse and the conversation about it, you know, France has said it's going to move ahead with this tax. Italy, Turkey, Austria, Spain, Belgium are all considering digital taxes. And the fact is that this is a real issue that does have to get solved. This question of kind of how you deal with companies of this size that fundamentally don't have boundaries. Mm-hmm. So there's talk of a global tax structure maybe being worked out within the OECD. That would be a major shift in global tax policy. But without a doubt, the conversation's far from over. And don't forget, despite what the president said, a lot of these big tech companies also don't pay their taxes in the United States.
Right, right. Interesting that this is country by country in Europe and it's not under the EU umbrella.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's what makes it so tricky. Now, France has said that were there to be an EU-wide agreement on taxation, they would be willing to go along with that. That's a hard thing to work out, and it wouldn't address any of the other countries that might come along and say that they also want a digital tax.
Molly Wood, she's a host of Marketplace Tech, talking digital tax stuff. Molly, thanks a lot.
My pleasure, Kai.
All right. So the second piece of that Mnuchin quote that deserves a second look is the bit where he said the United States is going to arbitrarily impose tariffs, which is not the way it works. Marketplace's Andy Euler's on that one.
Despite what the Treasury Secretary said in Davos, this administration can't arbitrarily impose taxes on whatever it wants. The imposition of tariffs on any foreign goods for national security reasons falls under Section 232 of the Trade Expansion Act.
There is a procedure for going through Section 232 and claiming national security.
That's Emily Blanchard. She's an economics professor at Dartmouth College. She says the argument the Trump administration put forward back in May of last year was unprecedented in U.S. trade policy.
That automobiles are a national security issue because they are important for the U.S. economy, and U.S. economic security is part of the broader national security.
The administration produced a report on why auto imports threaten national security, but the White House has refused to release the report to Congress, saying it would limit the administration's ability to negotiate further trade deals with Europe, Japan, and others. Jamie Butters at Automotive News says, in theory, he could see national security claims for auto imports.
If we imported all of our vehicles and we didn't have the ability to manufacture vehicles anymore, then we would be at a disadvantage from a defense standpoint.
But he says that's a tough line to walk given how globally intertwined the auto industry has become. And Emily Blanchard at Dartmouth says that's exactly why any auto tariffs would hurt American workers.
It's going to ripple up and down the supply chain to parts producers and then to further parts purchasers.
And ultimately, to the people buying those cars, the American consumer. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, up and then kind of not up. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. AMC is known for shows like Breaking Bad and The Walking Dead and Mad Men as well. Shows that dominated ratings before streaming companies started dominating people's eyeballs, right? Sarah Barnett is the president of AMC Networks Entertainment Group. That includes BBC America, Sundance TV, IFC, and of course, AMC and its own streaming server. She has been in the job about a year, an interesting year, I think, to take over a network with so much changing in the business of television. Sarah Barnett, thanks for coming in.
Pleasure.
I'm going to start with a very subjective question, okay? How do you know when something's going to be good on TV?
I guess I believe that everything in the end is subjective. Our gut knows better than any other part of us, I think, what's good, what's right. There's obviously all of the business side to it, and you need to be as focused, as analytical, to pull from as many inputs, to have as many insights as you possibly can. But then I think when you sort of have to forget about all of that, and you hope that it kind of synthesizes in the back of your brain somewhere. And then I think it's about having a great team who are out there talking to, turning over unlikely rocks to find new and fresh talent. And then I think it is an undeniable idea. Those ideas that you would be jealous if somebody else had. And those ideas that create a kind of shiver. Yeah. And then there's the execution piece. So, the knowing about the idea or the believing you know about an idea is just the beginning. Then there's the execution, which is every bit as sort of tortuous and exciting and rich and difficult as getting to the place of a genius concept.
I saw you described as a curator. Do you buy that?
I think it's a bit pretentious, but I probably fall back on it because I don't quite know what else to say. I mean, I think that my background is in marketing, and I think that I bring a sense of brand and a sense of building something that makes sense as a cohesive whole while never, ever being rigid about what that thing you're building is. You always have to be responsive to the changing world, the changing audience, the changing culture around you if what you're doing is going to resonate. You know, it's always a twisty, turny path. But I love what I do and I feel remarkably grateful.
I hear that about, the twisty, turny path. But to that shiver and loving what you do and to the meat of what it is that you do. Are these interesting times to be in television, good times or challenging times?
All of the above, for sure, and lots more. I mean, it has never been more wildly thrilling, massively anxious-making. It's never been more confounding to plot a path. But I think the only way to come at it, and I think that the remarkable nature of now in many ways, not just in TV, in many ways, is the sort of thrill of opening yourself up to just having sea legs. Whatever might have worked previously in whatever ways you thought you knew things may not be right. And so I think that surrounding yourself with people who you know, who are brilliant and who compliment you and who challenge you. I mean, that's crucial. It always has been, but I think more than ever.
I don't want to get into the what's it like being a female executive in this economy today and all of that, because I'm
that's
sure
that's a
you
whole
get,
other
no, I know, and,
weekend
and
of discussion.
And I'm sure you get those conversations all the time, but I this question will be seen as gendered, and I apologize for that both to you and to the listeners, but I'm genuinely curious. You are expressing more uncertainty to me now in this interview than many a CEO have ever dared to, and I find that really interesting.
Yeah. It's impossible not mm-hmm. to have a gendered mm-hmm. Explanation, I think, there. Although I will say, you know, a couple of things. Technically, I'm not a CEO. I'm a president of various bits of my organization.
Fair
enough. The CEO of AMC Networks, who is a guy called Josh Sullivan, is...
Who says very nice things about you. I mean,
but it's mutual. And I, the nice thing I'm about to say is he's a man who I think will express also some vulnerability and a confident ability to say, mm-hmm. yeah, you don't always know. You know, having said that, I would say that within his and I hope my expressions of doubt, I believe lies the strength to succeed. At times like now, when conventional wisdom might say you have to be enormous to survive, mm-hmm. it's why I believe AMC has always come out the other side of moments of disruption stronger. I think it's because we don't follow conventional wisdom and we do chart our own course, and that is done in a way that is, I think, rich and interesting.
Let me end with something you said early on about when I asked you how you know something's going to be good. And you said that thing, which I totally resonate with, about a sense of professional jealousy that you hadn't thought of it. What are you jealous about right now?
Succession. I mean, it has to be said. Succession is, I think, genius. And it's the kind of show that at AMC Networks, along with, you know, the Better Call Sauls, the Killing Eves, and the obviously Mad Men and Breaking Bad and Lodge 49 recently, and a ton of other things.
I mean, there's a legacy, right?
That there's such a rich legacy in the brands and shows that we have on AMC Networks. You think about the last decade of television without AMC Networks, it would mm-hmm. have been denuded in ways which would be, mm-hmm. frankly, pretty terrible for the work. And I think that one of the things, I don't know if I'm jealous. I'm not jealous of the big checkbooks that people have. I wouldn't say that, you know, money can be very helpful, and we all need enough money to do what we need to do in our businesses. But I don't think that sort of unfettered resource is ever great for the creative process. And
that's really interesting when streaming services are spending a gajillion dollars. As you said, they're nodding and pursing your lips.
It sure is.
Yeah.
It really is interesting. And I think that a world where there are, you know, 4 to 8 big companies, conglomerates making television with global audiences,
right.
risk gets squeezed out of that. I think algorithms optimize the same. And I think that what I'm interested in and what my team is interested in at AMC Networks is those things that aren't already proven. You know, Phoebe Waller-Bridge before Fleabag mm-hmm. had launched, and Vince Gilligan before he'd showrun a show, and many, many other examples. So thinking about how our platforms can put content in front of people that is connected to really rich brands and plays with the different ways that people are watching today, I think it's really mm-hmm. exciting.
Sarah Barnett, she's the president of AMC Networks. Sarah, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
We've got more from that interview, including how Sarah started her career in radio news. So I guess there's hope yet, right? It's on our Corner Office podcast. Netflix reported earnings the other day, about which two things. Number one, founder and CEO Reed Hastings says he is not interested in providing an ad-supported version of that service. Said he, there is no easy money there. Number two, U.S. subscriber numbers didn't grow as fast as the company had hoped. Hello, Apple TV Plus and Disney Plus and all the other new streaming options out there. Netflix did talk a lot about its new show, The Witcher, it's called. The company says the medieval fantasy is its most watched debut ever. But as Marketplace's Jasmine Garz reports, the way Netflix is adding up those views could be a fantasy all its own.
The Witcher starts with Henry Cavill and his chiseled jaw battling a gurgling swamp monster. According to Netflix, 76 million households watched, at least this far. Netflix counts people who watch the first 2 minutes of the show as viewers. So if you moved on to something else, you still boosted Netflix's ratings. Courtney Williams is with Parrot Analytics.
That two-minute period is enough of an indicator for them to be very clear indication of people completing it. So they don't have to go all the way through. They know with the 2 minutes what that means.
In medieval times, when TV shows were beholden to advertisers, ratings measured who watched entire shows. But Netflix is commercial-free and doesn't need to convince advertisers. Carnegie Mellon professor Pedro Ferreira says, with so many shows craving our attention, sticking around for 2 minutes, that's a lot.
There's just too much competition. As a consumer, you know very well that if you don't like the first 30 seconds or 1 minute, you can just move on to the next one.
But Netflix still has investors who want to know who kept watching. Tim Hanlon is the CEO of Vertir, a media advisory investment group.
It is proverbially grading one's own homework. And I mean, there has to be a bit more transparency.
Netflix probably knows how many people actually finished The Witcher, but unless investors press for some more details, we never will. I'm Jasmine Garz for Marketplace.
Coming up.
It is frustrating for the most people because it's expensive.
Moving to a new country when it's not really up to you. First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials down 9 today, less than a 10%, 29,186. The NASDAQ up 12, that's about a 10%, 93.83. S&P 500 basically flat, 33.21. Tech stocks did all right today. IBM up 3.3% on better-than-expected fourth-quarter profits. Apple polished up 0.3%. That's an all-time high. Their chip makers rallied as well. Micron Technology advanced 0.3%. Tesla up 4% today as the electric vehicle maker became the first publicly listed U.S. car maker to exceed $100 billion in market capitalization. That is, in case you're keeping track, more than Ford and General Motors combined. Ford stalled about 0.5%. GM slowed 0.2%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Boeing's new CEO, Dave Calhoun, has been on the job 9 days now, and he picked today to start changing perceptions of the company and its most infamous product, the 737 MAX, of course. Marketplace's Jack Stewart has been on the Boeing beat for us. Hey, Jack.
Hi, Kai.
So what did Mr. Calhoun have to say?
Well, as you say, this was sort of a signaling of a change of guard, if you like. He seemed to be saying that, look, we're going to be more open going forward. So there's going to be more communication coming from Boeing. So he spoke first to employees, and then he actually did a media press call as well and talked a lot about, obviously, the 737 MAX and how that plane will eventually get back into service. Yesterday, Boeing released a statement with an estimate for that return to service of mid-2020, a way out. And also interesting that they put a firm date on it. Until now, it's always been like, oh, you know, the end of the month, the end of the year, it's coming, we'll get there.
But help me out here, right? Because the FAA has been pretty insistent that they're the ones who are going to decide. And yet here's Boeing now saying, midsummer.
Yes, but again, Calhoun, in perhaps a departure from his predecessor, Dennis Muilenburg, was quite clear that that decision was the FAA's and other global aviation safety regulators. But they said in this statement that they wanted to put a date on there because it helps everybody to get prepared and get organized, at least to kind of have an idea of when it's going to happen.
Those who have to be organized are, of course, airlines, which are now still saying we're not going to be able to use this plane all summer.
Yeah, because airlines like certainty in their schedules. This is always the thing. So, you know, until they know for a fact that that plane is flyable, they will not put it back in their schedules. So we're entering, you know, another busy summer period in a few months' time. And this will be the second summer period that they haven't had the MAX because it was grounded last March. So that's a big deal for the airlines that fly it. In the U.S., that's American, United, and Southwest. United came out yesterday saying that it was going to – actually earlier today saying it was going to remove it from its schedules right the way through the summer. And, you know, they just, they're hoping that what they see as this more realistic timeline will actually pay off.
Okay, so if midsummer means, say, July, that's 6 months from now, they've said that's when they're going to start, and here's my favorite buzzword of the week, ungrounding this airplane. It's not like July comes and they fire up the generator on this plane and it goes, right? Ungrounding will take a while.
It'll take a while because these planes have been parked up. They need maintenance. They need checking. They'll need some fixes based on what the final fix for this aircraft is before they're even put back into service. Now Boeing has also stopped the production line, although it's saying that it might actually start that back up even before the plane is certified to fly, just to try and get things rolling again and get this thing back in the air.
And there is, of course, the issue of the following companies, which is why this is such a big deal for the American economy and could cost GDP points. There's that firm in Kansas City that makes fuselages, Spirit, that has laid off 2,000 people. I mean, this is a systemic thing.
The supply chain that Boeing has is just enormous. It stretches across this country and across the world. And yeah, the implications for all of those people are now beginning to be felt.
Jack Stewart on the Boeing story today. Thanks, Jack.
Thank you.
More aviation news tomorrow. Of course, American and Southwest report earnings before the bell, each of which have been hit hard by the 737 MAX grounding, as Jack was saying. David Brancaccio and the gang will have all of that on the Marketplace Morning Report tomorrow. I saw this on Bloomberg the other day, that Venezuela has less than $1 billion in cash left total in the bank. Yeah, they've got gold, but American sanctions mean they don't have any real market access to turn that into money. It's just another symptom of the political and the economic and the humanitarian crisis that Venezuela has been dealing with for the better part of a decade now, a crisis that the United Nations says has forced more than 4 million people to leave that country. Almost 300,000 Venezuelans have migrated to Chile since 2016, and that includes a lot of professionals who now can't work in their chosen fields. Paige Sutherland met some of them in the Chilean capital, Santiago.
When Sandra Rodriguez isn't working at her office job downtown, she picks up shifts at her father's restaurant to help pay the bills. She came to Chile 3 years ago to give her two children a better life, but it hasn't been easy.
We miss so many things. Our friends, our home.
Back in Venezuela, Sandra was a manager working in the accounts department of a private company. She has two master's degrees, more than 20 years experience, and had taught economics at a local college. But here in Chile, she's had to go back to college and prepare for a degree-level exam for her qualifications to be recognized. Applying for revalidation is a costly and lengthy process. Sandra started 2 years ago, and she's not alone. Francesca Aguilera works in Chile's only revalidation office, based at the university. She says it's been a hectic few years, with the number of applications from Venezuelans increasing every year, and only 8 staff to process them.
I think a lot of the staff were worn out because this avalanche of applications kept coming, and the office wasn't hiring enough people to keep up.
For Venezuelans, the political crisis at home means getting a hold of legal documents can be very complicated. Victor Rengel reels off the jobs he did while he tracked down his official documents, something which took him 3 years. He was an office boy, a mailman, a fireman, and even sold beauty products at a hair salon.
Hello?
Hola, muy buenos días, doña Carolina.
Buen día.
Hola, mucho gusto. Mi nombre es Victor. Le hablo de Corner Shop.
Now, as he waits for revalidation, this qualified lawyer delivers food from supermarkets for customers who've ordered through an app. Victor says he didn't want to leave Venezuela. The life there was becoming unbearable. So at the age of 31, he packed up and came to Chile with his wife.
Emigrar de tu país.
Emigrating from your country, it was like divorcing someone when you are still in love. To leave your heart is to leave everything. But we needed to do this to have a normal life again.
Hola.
Hola.
Patricia Rojas works for a nonprofit organization trying to make the revalidation process smoother for Venezuelans. According to a recent economic report, 74% of Venezuelans in Chile are underemployed, the largest of any migrant population. Patricia says some have even gone back to Venezuela because the process was too hard.
It is frustrating for the most people because it's expensive, because it's difficult, and because it's slow. And when you're fleeing a humanitarian crisis, we expect a bit more of solidarity. We've never asked to bend the rules, but I think the process can be easier.
For now, Victor can only check out his grocery delivery and, like Sandra, count the days until he can return to the job he was trained for. Many in Congress here agree the process is cumbersome. But with a social crisis of its own, the issue is not a priority for Chile's lawmakers. In Santiago, Chile, I'm the BBC's Paige Sutherland for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today. You think you got trouble managing your finances? Allow me to introduce you, ladies and gentlemen, to the United States Department of Defense. A government report due out today, and Bloomberg had the story, it shows the Pentagon made $35 trillion in accounting adjustments last year. $35 trillion. That's double counting and triple counting and quadruple counting the same money. So just for scale here, the Pentagon's whole actual budget for FY20, single counting this money, is $738 billion. All right, we're out of here. Dow Industrial's down 9 today. That's less than a 10%. NASDAQ up 12. That is about a 10%. The S&P 500 basically flat. Our media production team includes Sarah Bruguer, Robin Edgar, Drew Jostad, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, Jay Siebold, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Holliday. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.